I gave you a book for Christmas.
You did.
You had told me you weren't like a big, big reader, mm-hmm. but I gave you a book about something you like.
Yes. The book's called Buck Buck Moose. It's by Hank Shaw. And it was a great Christmas present, just because one of the reasons that I primarily got into hunting was because of the clean eating, the food that, like, I know that this isn't full of preservatives. It doesn't have
growth
hormones.
You like to know where your food came from.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. So Hank Shaw, for those who don't know, is considered an expert, maybe even the expert these days, on cooking wild game. But he wasn't always a food writer. He actually was a political reporter for 18 years.
Crazy.
Crazy. I know. What a transition, right? Hunter, angler, gardener, cook won the best food blog by the James Beard Foundation in 2013. It's considered the Oscars of the food world. And it's such a big deal that that's really what led to his big pivot. He's been featured twice in the book Best Food Writing by DeCapo Press. So on this, dying to ask, how Hank knew it was time to quit his political reporting day job and to go all in on being a food writer. We're going to talk about foraging. Like, if you got, well, I know you could, but like if most of us got stranded in the woods, could we forage and find something to eat? I think the answer is probably no.
How long would you survive?
Not long. And we'll talk about what it's like to be a food writer, everything from turning pheasant into a photo op to coming up with words to describe what the texture of some of the food is like, you know, beyond it tastes like.
Like chicken?
Like chicken. Yeah. And why do people say that?
It's a good question.
I know. Well, we'll get answers. Hank Shaw is our guest on Dying to Ask. I'm Deirdre Fitzpatrick, and I am obsessed with knowing how people do things. I write the book, they start the company, they go from idea to reality. I call it the art of the follow-through, and I want to know how people go from A to B. This is the Dying to Ask podcast. Hank Shaw, thanks for coming in today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. I know you do a lot of podcasts.
I do.
What, you're telling me like once a week?
Sometimes. Depends on the time of year.
Okay. I guess if it's hunting time, you're busy.
Weirdly, no, actually.
What?
Because everybody's hunting.
Oh, I see.
It's the spring and the summer and the lead up and the you know, late winter, too, when everybody's done hunting. They're like, I have all this game. What do I do with it?
Right. Then they need Hank Shaw, for sure. Well, I always joke with Jeff, anytime we have anybody who's a runner, and I'm a runner, it's hard for him to get a word in edgewise, or he has zero interest. And I feel like this is going to be, the tables are turned, because Jeff, on our team, he's the one with the hunting background. So I know he's going to be picking your ear a lot on this one. Yeah.
I also have a history of running, too.
Oh, you do? Well, there you go. Wow. I'm back in the game.
Yeah, both worlds.
Yeah, I was a national class distance runner in a former life.
Holy cow. Really?
Mm-hmm.
You have a lot of former lives.
I do.
You do. Okay, so let's talk a little bit. Let's talk about the current life, and then we'll go back in time to all your prior lives. But tell us a little bit about your life as a food writer these days and what you've been up to.
So it's been kind of a wild ride. I moved to California in 2004 to cover Arnold Schwarzenegger. And that was fairly entertaining. And
a lot of people thought that was wild game at the time. I covered that one as well.
He was an interesting guy. I may or may not be the only person to have ever covered Jesse Ventura and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I remember that one. I was working in the Midwest.
Because I moved here from Minnesota. And so I did that until I was among the many, many, many journalists who were purged in 2006 to 2008. So they closed the Capitol Bureau that I was working at.
So you worked as a political reporter?
Yes.
For how many years?
Oh boy, 18?
That's a long time.
Yeah, it's a fair bit.
Yeah.
But I started the website and really started into food in the early 2000s. And the reason was because I'm sure everybody listening to this has something that you're very good at, but you don't necessarily love it. And there's such a thing as kind of handcuffs, where I'm really good at this thing, and this thing either helps feed my family or for whatever. But it's not really what's, you know, blowing your skirt up anymore.
Yeah.
And so I took my inspiration from an old New York Times reporter named Johnny Apple, and R.W. Apple was his byline.
What a great byline.
Right?
I'm R.W. Apple.
So he was a political reporter for a dog's age in the 60s and 70s. And then by the 80s, he got tired of it and became a food writer. So I figured I could be the poor man's Johnny Apple. And it started to snowball here and there. And then, you know, once I lost my full-time job at the Stockton Record, I started to make it a little bit bigger push, and then I got nominated for a James Beard Award in 2009,
that'll
and then
do
in
it.
2010.
So the blog that you started was called?
Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook.
And the angle of it was?
Hunting, angling, gardening.
Very self-explanatory. Thanks for that. But the angle was not, you know, was really the idea of kind of getting out there, finding your food, and then knowing what to do with it.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you ask me about the 30,000 foot view of why I do what I do, it's because as a species, we're spending more and more time in boxes. We look at the boxes on in our living rooms. We drive to work in a box. We usually work in a box. And we all worship the little boxes that are in our pockets. And we're so divorced from the natural world, which is really, we're part of the natural world. We're not different from it. We're a piece of it, for good or for ill. And the problem with our interaction with the natural world is that if you think it's a museum, you won't touch it. And then if you don't touch it, it becomes something that maybe you see once and you don't interact with it. It's not really part of who you are. So what I want and what I'm hoping people do is take a piece of nature and make it theirs, whether it's picking blackberries along the American River Trail, or if it's turkey hunting, or if it's fishing for salmon or halibut in the bay, something, you know, so make something interactive with nature, part of what your family does and what you do. And then you will care if it goes away. And it's a much more, you'll have more skin in the game if you are actively taking a part in nature.
Did you have that already when you started the blog? Did you grow up like this? You did.
I did not grow up as a hunter. I grew up as an angler and a forager. So, I mean, our family is, I'm from the East Coast. I'm originally from New Jersey. And my mom is from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Really Ipswich, but nobody knows Ipswich. And so digging clams and picking beach peas and blueberries and that sort of thing, it's part of our family's DNA. And I mean, I think my mom taught me how to fish probably I could barely walk. So fishing has been something that has been integral to who I am for, well, my whole life.
Yeah.
And I didn't pick up hunting until shortly before I moved here. I picked it up in Minnesota, and it felt like completing a circle. You know, I'd had plants and I'd had fish. And then the other piece to that stool is game. And, my friend Chris, who was a reporter with me in St. Paul, he kind of gave me the nudge I needed, and I guess he kind of created a monster.
Or you owe him a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's like right now, I don't think I've bought meat for the house more than a handful of times since 2005.
That's amazing. Because it's so different than the way most of us live. I mean, certainly me, I didn't grow up in a hunting family, fishing some now, but but definitely didn't grow up with that kind of exposure to it. And I think probably most Americans these days don't have that familiarity.
Yeah, that's accurate. I mean, I think the vast majority of Americans are non-hunters. There are some who are actively opposed to hunting, and then there are some people who actually hunt. But the vast majority, something like 92%+ of the United States, is just they're just not hunters. You know, they're not for or against it. They're just sort of there.
So do you think if the economy hadn't tanked around 2008 and the job situation hadn't changed, would you have taken that leap? Like, how did you know go all in on this thing that I love?
It was the Beard Award nominations. So if you're familiar with the movie Julie and Julia, there's this moment when she gets written up in the New York Times where her phone can't stop ringing, and she gets da-da-da-da, it all sort of happens. Well, I mean, it wasn't voicemail because this was the 2000s.
Right.
but it basically, that happened. So I got a book deal after the second Beard nomination, and a dear friend who died of breast cancer, actually, a woman named Pam Hunter, she took me aside, and she was sort of a, I don't know what you would call it, maybe a sort of a food impresario. She knew everybody, and she was from Napa. And she took me aside, and she said, you know, at some point you're going to have to decide whether you do this full-time or not, and I think you can. And she just barely got to see me do it. So I did I did sort of step off the cliff in April of 2010. I used to work for a publication called the Capital Morning Report after the Stockton Record. And I resigned there in April 2010, and I have never missed a mortgage payment.
That's so amazing. Congratulations on that. 9 years now. What was that first morning like when you realized I'm kind of the boss?
Did you have that moment? Well, it kind of hit later, you know, when you're kind of in a blur of like, how are you going to make your next mortgage payment? How are you going to make this happen? My one piece of fiscal advice for anybody wishing to do something like I'm doing, in other words, like go out on your own, live like a church mouse as long as you can, because I had a year's worth of salary in the bank. Well, that's not entirely true. I had a year's worth of living expenses in the bank. And that provides you with the emotional calm for when you're not bringing in any money or much money for the first several months, because you're like, all right, I got some time, I can do this. And without that, that would have never happened.
So the first book was called?
Hunt, Gather, Cook.
And who was your audience that you wanted to bring in with that? And were there a lot of people in that kind of realm at that point doing things like that?
There's always a bunch of us doing this sort of thing. There's way more now than there was.
That's because everybody's seen your Instagram. Looks pretty good.
There's probably a little truth to that. It's not really Instagram so much as just the, you know, I've been doing this a long time. This is my 12th year. And the website averages 1 million readers a month. So, I mean,
that's amazing.
It's got size to it. Almost all in the United States, but, you know, go Canada.
We have some Canadian listeners on the podcast as well. We love them. We love you the most. No, not kidding. We love everybody equally, of course.
Well, my grandparents on both sides are Canadian, so I've kind of got a foot up there.
And so, you know, when you go off on your own and you start writing, I mean, you really have an opportunity, especially when there weren't as many people in it, to kind of chart where you want to go. And some of it is you have the opportunity to educate people on things they probably never even would have thought about. So what was that like when you started out?
It's always throwing spaghetti on the wall in the beginning. Like, if you look at my really oldest stuff, like I'm doing wine reviews, I'm just doing stuff that I just don't do anymore. You know, at one point I thought I wanted to grow grapes, and I still do grow grapes, but they're just in my backyard.
Yeah.
And I make a mean Graciano. But, you know, because think about it, those vines are all 15, 16 years old now.
Right,
so,
right.
But yeah, you know, you go along and you do whatever it is that you're doing, and you see, well, this has resonance and this doesn't. And then there are some things that people are hungry for that you do, and you feed that hunger. And then there's some things that feed your own hunger. You know, there's some aspects of what I do that aren't super popular, but I'm not going to stop doing them. So you kind of work your way and you feel your niche out, and then hopefully you fill it.
I'm pausing so that you can jump in, because I thought I wouldn't be able to hang with you two, but clearly I'm doing just fine. So what's in your little brain right now?
I think most of my questions are stuff that we're going to cover.
You want
to next section?
I see. Okay, yeah. We want to talk to you about foraging and like the actual act, because I think that's one of the things that I know Jeff and I are intrigued by, because I feel like if I was dropped into a forest and I had to survive for a while, I'm not sure I would know exactly where to go and what to do. And the interesting thing after reading your blog is seeing how much is actually out there and how much as Americans, especially, we don't really know. So if you're good with that, we'll talk about that after the break.
Sure.
All right, we're back with more with Hank Shaw in just a minute. Jeff, you know how when you plant a garden, you water it so it will grow?
In theory, mm-hmm. Yes. I've not done this myself.
Yeah, that's not how podcasts work, though. We need ratings and reviews. So please take a second when this episode finishes and leave us a quick review on Apple iTunes. I read all of them, and whoever ID'd themselves as L3SF and suggested that I slow down a little bit, you were right. So thanks for the feedback. Back to the show. When you launch something like you did, you it's good to have kind of an idea where you want to go, or maybe the kind of persona you want to do. And somebody who it sounds like was inspirational to you was Emeril.
Yeah, in a way. Emeril and Julia Child before him, because there's a funny movie that many of you have probably seen. It's called Ratatouille. So Ratatouille, even though it's a cartoon, is the, in my opinion, the single best representation of how a kitchen actually works. there's the dead chef who's the spirit of the whole thing. So anybody can cook. And the thing about that is Julia and Emeril, they come from a position of yes. that you can do this and I'm going to help you do this. And it's especially important with fish and game because you can't just go to the store and buy moose.
Right. I mean, like, you mess up the moose, you're kind of toast.
Right. And so what happens with game is that everybody has these two or three recipes that sometimes are generational and they're often horrible, but it's a way for the family, well, they'll choke it down and they'll be okay.
Well, just like grandpa made.
Yeah, you know, well, with Emeril and with Julia, they had their whole show was showing everyone that you can do these seemingly chefy techniques and it's really not that hard. I'm going to break it down for you. So that's been kind of that's been a guiding light for me for the whole 12 years I've been doing this, is that I come from a professional cooking background. Before I was a newspaper reporter, I was a restaurant chef.
What have you not done?
Quite a bit, actually.
You had me running. I was good there.
Yeah, I never ran a kitchen or anything, but I was, you know, I was a low level sous chef.
You'd been exposed to food. Mm-hmm. So when you start combining these and going out, what is it about wild game that you find so interesting? What is it about that experience of hunting for you?
Chaos. To be a cook of wild game and fish is to embrace chaos.
Because?
Every animal's different. You can go to a supermarket and buy chicken every day for your whole life. It'll be more or less the same. You can buy beef or even farm salmon. It's all going to be more or less the same. Let's just take Sacramento area. So we live in the wintering ground for the entire Pacific Flyway. It's one of the greatest places to hunt ducks and geese on the planet.
You concur, Jeff?
Yeah.
It's just, we have the best limits. We have some best, great public land. I mean, it's one of the, I'm a public land hunter and, you know, we have tremendous opportunity. Well, okay. There's something like 23 different species of ducks that you can hunt and they're all different. They're not, and what makes them different is not only size, but diet. So every species has a different diet and even within species. So an example is a gadwall. So a gadwall is they'll call it a gray duck. So it's a medium-sized duck, and they're
I've
very
common.
I've
never even heard of that before.
Ah, see? There you go. Wikipedia. So a gad, say if you hunt it up in Gray Lodge, you know, north of Sacramento, it's going to be eating rice, and it's going to be delicious. That same bird could spend a couple weeks down in the grasslands in Merced and eat just green things, and they call them gagwalls down there. So it's the same bird, but it has this different massive differences to it. You know, a mallard, just a regular green-headed mallard, right? So if he's eating rice or he's eating acorns or if he's, you know, eating tadpoles or eating dead salmon, they'll eat all of these things. And as a cook, you have to embrace that and have to have a very keen eye. You know, a rutting big, big old bull moose is going to be vastly different at the table than, say, a cow moose or a raghorn, you know. So there's all of these variables. So, you know, grouse, there's like seven or eight different species of grouse, and there's like eight different species of squirrel. So, I mean, there's all these different things that you get as an opportunity to play with. And, you know, just think about fish, right? You know, there's tons of, like, you can go rock fishing, and yeah, sure, most rockfish are more or less the same, but there's subtle differences in a certain species that you can bring out as a cook that you just can't do if you're going to the supermarket.
Super challenging too.
Yeah. I think one thing that when you're talking about making this accessible to everyone, does that go into foraging also? Like, your average person isn't going to go out and be like, oh, look, mushrooms. I wonder if it's going to kill me, you know? Like,
take a bite. Let's find out.
Oh, my God. My favorite DM ever, we came on Twitter about 6 years ago. I just ate this mushroom. Can you help me identify what it was?
How did you respond?
I said, please take photos of the ones that were next to it, and maybe I can help you not die. Turns out the thing about mushrooms, real quick, is that they're like people. Like 10% you'd crawl over glass for, 10% should be flushed down the toilet, and everybody else is on a bell curve in between. So that person's mushroom was in the bell curve.
Fortunately for them.
Yeah.
When it comes to this concept of foraging and getting out and identifying vegetables and fruits, honestly, like, a lot of us have never heard of some of these things. And there is a great amount of food just kind of out there.
There is, even in your own yard. Most common household weeds were brought here for food. My favorite example, and it's warm weather months now here in Sacramento, purslane.
What is it called?
Purslane. If you speak Spanish, it's verdolagas.
Okay.
And it's super common vegetable in Mexico and in some other parts of the cuisine. Germans like it too. And it's a common garden weed. I guarantee you, if you have a garden and you're listening to this, it's in your garden. And it's delicious. It's fantastic. It's sort of vaguely succulent. It's vaguely tart and lemony and juicy. We don't actually know if it's native or not. So like that's actually a funny one. Like asparagus, there's some debate over whether it's native or not. But like dandelions were brought here for food. And there's right. a whole bunch of other things that were brought here for food. I think part of what I do, sort of the plant side of what I do, is to prevent green blindness. It was very important. My mother thought it was very important for her children to know the names of things so that it's not just a tree, it's an elm. Mm-hmm. It's not just a bush, it's a rugosa rose. So the eating parts of it, when especially with children, makes it fun, right? So the rugosa roses are a beachside rose with very simple pink and white flowers that have very big rose hips that you can actually eat like a cherry pepper. Hmm. You don't eat the seeds. They're what you use. The seeds of a rose hip are used in itching powder. So you eat around the seeds. But to know the names of things, to just walk down a street tomorrow. And everybody listen to this. We just walk down a street. What plants can you name on your walk? I guarantee you, unless you're a botanist listening to this, chances are it's less than 50%.
Oh, absolutely.
Less than 10%.
Yeah, I know. You're giving us a lot of credit.
It's not hard. People think I'm some sort of like druid or something for being able to do this. And it's just I've spent some mental energy learning structures and plants because mm-hmm. human beings are extraordinarily good at pattern recognition. It's one of the things that we're very good. In fact, the whole theory of conspiracy theories of why humans really dig conspiracy theories, like you know, whether on the left or the right or aliens or whatever, is because we want to see patterns even when there aren't actually patterns. So, but that ability is hardwired into our genus long before we were Homo sapiens to be, it's really a primate thing. The other thing is about color. It's like we're the only primate with really good, we're one of the only mammals with really good color vision. Well, that's because the difference between everybody here has eaten a red blackberry, correct?
Right.
Blackberries should be black, not red.
But if you see them out on the trails, aren't they?
They're black. The red ones aren't ripe.
Right.
So you all know this because you ate that one. It's like, how do you know the oven's hot? So you ate the horribly tart, not ripe red blackberry, but your eyes now are keen towards, oh, it's got to be black. If it's not black, it's not going to be good. And if you see the little red hue at the base of that blackberry, yeah. or if it doesn't pull off, that's the key. Actually, if you're going to pick blackberries, if it doesn't pull off easy, don't force it. It's not ready. So this eye pattern recognition and your ability to see color is all hardwired. And what I try to do is just bring that out and sort of bring out your inner human.
Yeah, my husband's family lives out on a ranch. It's about in Montana. Middle of nowhere. It's one of the most remote places in the country that you can still get to by car, but it takes you an hour and a half to get to
North Central?
It's central. It's on the Boulder River.
Yeah.
So great fishing.
Good bird hunting too.
Oh yeah. Good everything, you know. But what I'm always so impressed by with people there, even young people, is how resourceful they are because if no matter what they break, no matter what they need, if you don't have it, you got to make it, find it, create it because you can't just go buy it at the store. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, to me, what you're talking about with foraging and hunting and fishing and being resourceful is it's a lot of that. And we've lost that as a culture quite a bit. Our lives are pretty easy.
They are. But, you know, I don't want to, you know, sit here and poop on, you know, regular normal people, right? Because you're good at other things. You know, you've just decided that your brain needs to know these other things. Like, let's say, you know, you're listening to this in New York City. I guarantee you, you know the subway system.
Absolutely.
I don't have to know the subway system. I do because I used to live in New York, but I don't have to anymore. You know, so that you fill your brain with what is important and what you need. And the problem with that right now is normal human society is divorced from nature so that what you need and what's in front of your face is not dealing with a natural world. Someone in central Montana, you're surrounded by it. So you have to be aware of it and you have to be more resourceful in that way.
What do you think? You mentioned, you know, challenging yourself to just walking down the street and trying to identify things. But what are good ways, if people are inspired, to get their kids out there or themselves to learn a little bit more about what's out there? How would you do it?
I think there are occasionally plant walks that are available. I do them every now and again. I think another fun way is there's actually a colleague of mine's book called The Backyard Forager. Her name is Ellen Zakos. That's pretty cool, right? You know, you start with your yard or start with a nearby park and stuff, and just to see and identify. Now, picking and foraging, there's some legalities and safety issues that we can get into, but just to identify, that's not going to hurt anything.
Yeah, don't forage in your neighbor's backyard.
Well, unless you've got permission, you know. But I think starting with your own yard and identifying, well, what grows there?
Who are your listeners and readers these days?
It's all over the place. I mean, one of the things that makes me happiest is when I do an event. So whenever I have books out, I travel all over the country and also Canada, and you know, I'll see who comes. And one of my favorite things in the world to see is a big old, you know, dually, like, you know, you can pry my gun for my cold dead hands bumper sticker next to a Prius that's with a coexist sticker, and that actually happens. It actually happens where you see people from very diametrically opposed viewpoints on everything else. They'll show up to an event because one thing that they do share is a love of wild food. And if I can have some tiny little, you know, influence to help show that people are not quite as divided as they think they are, that's a good thing.
Do you hate the, you know, I feel like we have a lot of people too who are just anti-hunting, period.
Yeah.
Do you get much on that?
I don't get a ton of it because I don't hunt anything I don't eat. You know, I'm specifically hunting to feed myself and those who I love. So sure, there's going to be people who say that's not a valid thing. And that's fine. You know, everybody's entitled to their opinion. But most people are like, oh, well, you eat it? That's cool. Like, I was just talking to a guy at a tire shop. I blew a tire when I was going up mushroom hunting. And so I come back and I'm like, yeah, you know, Tess talking about it. He said, what are you doing? I was going up there mushroom hunting. He's like, yeah, you hunt too? I'm like, yeah. I was wearing a camo hat.
Yeah.
And he's...
It was kind of a good clue.
Well, yeah. And I was kind of getting stink eye from this guy. And then he's like, well, do you eat it? I'm like, yeah, of course. I wouldn't hunt anything I don't eat. And he's like, oh, okay. So, like, I get that a lot, and I don't really – I mean, have I shot big deer a couple times, but I don't care. I mean, I'm just – I'm here to eat venison. I'm not there for giant racks.
And you talk, Jeff, I know a lot about the concept of clean eating.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's time for a quick break, but I'd love to get into this right after that.
We'll talk clean eating with Jeff. We'll get into that right after this. Do you love politics? Well, check out The Trail. Anyone who wants to be president has to go to New Hampshire first. This is a new Hearst Television podcast from our friends at WMUR-TV in New Hampshire.
How fun.
I know. The host, Adam Sexton, interviews all the people who want to live at 1600 Pennsylvania. And the way this 2020 campaign is shaping up, Adam's got a whole lot of episodes to record. Oh, you might have to help him with that. Check out The Trail from New Hampshire to the White House, wherever you get your podcasts.
So one of the reasons that I initially got into hunting was just because I wanted to know where's my meat coming from? Where's the food that I'm eating coming from? Like, what's being put into it? All of that. And the more I talk to other hunters, the more I hear about that and just kind of clean eating. And it's all organic, like grass-fed, like good food. Is that similar to what you've found?
It is a big reason why I actually started hunting. Mm-hmm. I'll first to admit I'm not a monk. It's not like I go to restaurants. I'm like, I'm not going to eat any of the meat. But at home,
like, oh my gosh, it's anxious.
At home though, I've always, you know, decided like I do want to divorce myself from the industrial meat system, and I've been very successful at it. You know, it takes a while to get the skill level and to be the time to be out there enough to fill your larder. But once you get good at it, it's surprisingly easy to hunt and fish enough meat for your family for a year. It surprised me that it was that easy.
How many freezers do you have?
Just two. So I've got the one in the kitchen, and then I've got a small box freezer. It's about the size of this table, maybe a little smaller. And the reason why is because if I buy a bigger freezer, I'll fill it. And that's a bad thing, right? Because you don't want to, like, we know what we can eat in a year. And there are many times during a year where we're like, nope, I'm going to go watch football.
During deer season?
Yeah. I mean, if I already have a deer in the ground, chances are I'm probably not going to go for a second or third or fourth, because I will if I know, because I have we all have circles of friends and family and colleagues who need venison or whatever because they either can't hunt anymore or whatever. And so as long as there have been human beings, there have been networks of hunters and then hunter people who benefit from the results of hunting.
Yeah. That's another question I had. You mentioned earlier that you didn't grow up hunting. Mm-hmm. Typically, most hunters, it's passed down from their father, from their grandfather, great-grandfather. What was that like trying to learn how to do that?
It was really interesting. I taught myself how to duck hunt at Gray Lodge. And for anyone listening here who I walked in on your decoy spread, sorry. it's a lot of trial and error. And, you know, my advice for if you're a new hunter and you really want to get into it is to listen to people who know how to hunt and to go with guides and talk to the guides, you know, guided duck hunt or guided pig hunt or something like that. And before you even go on the hunt, ask the guys, hey, I'm really new and I want to learn. Can you help me learn? And if that guide is receptive on the phone before you go on the hunt, go for it. If a guy's like, meh, 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 then find another guide. Yeah. Because I learned so much from professional guides when I was just starting out. So, you know, that's what it's supposed to look like. Or, oh, that's what you do. So there's a tremendous learning curve in both mushroom hunting and actual hunting that you just have to do your homework.
Can we talk about the business of what you do? Because I'm kind of fascinated by that as well. You know, you've published a couple of books. You have the blog, lots of social. What's a day like as a food writer? It sounds super glam, but I'm guessing that it's maybe not as glamorous as it sounds all the time. Like, what do you do in a day?
Well, I do work from home, but I'm in the field a fair bit because it's funny. I started this whole thing by talking about how we're tied to our boxes. Kind of am too. I'm not unlike everybody else because, you know, my livelihood in a great way depends on the internet. So Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook is the core of what I do. And then I have a Facebook forum called Hunt, Gather, Cook. And I'm on Instagram and I publish books. So every day is a juggle of, well, you know, what needs to be done today? Sometimes it's maintenance on the website. Sometimes there's an issue with the site. Sometimes there's an issue with my publishing company. Sometimes there's this and that and the other thing. So there's that mechanical grunt work, you know, taxes, that kind of stuff, you know, got to pay the tax man. So it's not all glam, but like before I got here, I had to water the garden and I'm growing all sorts of really weird stuff. And just side note, the smartest garden is the garden that you can't buy things from. So I focus my garden on varieties and things that you cannot get at the farmer's market or the supermarket. Because if I can get something that I really love at the supermarket or the farmer's market, why would I grow it?
I love it. So what's in there?
I've been on a Mexican bender for the last year and I'm to the point where I'm actually—
That sounds bad.
Yeah. There's a fair bit of mezcal involved. But I'm, you know, I'm to the point where I'm learning Spanish so that ultimately, and this will be years down the road, I can spend enough time down in Mexico to write a Mexican cookbook.
Oh, that's great.
I'm not there yet because it's, as you probably can tell, that I want to be really thoroughly knowledgeable about my subject before I go out and put myself out there.
Keep the mezcal going. That'll help.
Right. but so the my last two books were self-published. And the first one, the one that's here, Buck Buck Moose, the venison cookbook, that one became a reality thanks to a Kickstarter campaign. And I was able to raise $109,000 to get that book on the road. And that really is what created the system that allows me to continue to do books and make a fair living.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like I live in a big house or drive an old car. So, but I can keep a roof over my head and pay my mortgage, and the ability to do this has been really life changing because now I can publish books that I want to publish and I don't have to put it in front of a mainstream publisher who may not know how to sell that book.
It's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful book, beautiful pictures. So when you go out and you're working on the blog, like give me an example of it, like a a hunting expedition you would go do, and then and how you would formulate the idea and what it's actually like.
Sure, let's do fishing because okay. that's the most recent. I went down to Orange County the other day, and we were looking for yellowtail because yellowtail is one of my favorite fish in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's hamachi if you go to a sushi market.
Yeah.
So
it's expensive if you go to the market.
It's cheaper if you catch it.
Yes.
So I went down there, and we caught one yellowtail. We caught a bunch of rockfish. We caught a variety of tilefish they call an ocean whitefish. We caught a California sheep's head, and we caught bonita. So you catch all these fish, and you're like, all right, well, as soon as you they come on board, thinking like, all right, how am I going to cook these fish? So that trip had a point. We did get one yellowtail, so I did manage to get enough to do one good recipe on that. But then there was all the other things. And this happens all the time where, you know, what you went into and what you planned for didn't exactly happen. So you pivot. And so then that allows me to do a whole bunch of research. I'm like, well, you know, California sheephead is kind of a soft fish, but it only eats crabs. So what some people have done, and they catch them in Mexico, so I can read in Spanish. So I was looking up Spanish recipes for this fish. And what they do is they do a salpicón where they basically poach it and then flick it like as if it was crab and then serve it like that. And so I was, boom, there's my idea there. So that's kind of an example of, you know, and then bonita. You know, bonita is a little baby tuna. It's not actually a baby tuna, but it's a small species of tuna-like mm-hmm. fish. It's hated on by so many anglers. It's like, oh, they're garbage. Well, just by that, we could do an entire podcast about fish prejudice. So many people who have
We were just talking about that.
I know, right? You know, like, this fish is terrible. Like, how do you know? Somebody told me. Like, you know, they don't really know.
But that's great fodder for writing.
Totally.
That's like perfect. You just got like four ideas out of that one excursion.
And I have an entire series that I've been doing off and on for 12 years called Loving the Unloved. And that's another big thing that's very close to my heart is to find something that people like to hate on and say, A, you're wrong, and B, here's how you do it.
Yeah. Do you ever run into writer's block when it comes to describing things? Because sometimes food writers will rely on almost any writer, regardless of what their kind of beat is. You fall into these traps using the same types of words. Do you ever fall into that, or is that a challenge?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, but you catch yourself. I mean, I've been writing professionally for, well, I don't know, what is it? Close to 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Geez, God, it is getting old. So yeah, I mean, there's that little molecule in my brain.
Right.
You're using tasty too much.
Tasty. It seems like a lot of times with a lot of these wild game that you mentioned, most of us probably haven't tried that. So mm-hmm. I would imagine the number one question you get from people is, "What does it taste like?"
Yeah, and I think for the most part, there's a store bought analog. Like venison. Eat bison or eat grass-fed beef, and it's pretty close.
What about bear?
Bear's an interesting one. So bear's a leaner for a lot of people. Most people only eat black bears, like the species black bears. They can have different fur, but yeah. Species black bear. For 100 years, it has been slipping from typical food item to thing that you grow up with stuffed and as a comforting thing. So,
mm-hmm. I was going to say, it's in sausage a lot, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
But eating-wise, the best way I can describe it is beef, but the fat is like pork fat. Mm. So the fat has a very, very – is very, very similar to pork fat, but the meat is very beefy. I don't hunt bears very often.
What about pheasant?
Pheasant is, well, depending on how you treat it, pheasant is a very tricky to cook chicken.
Okay. It's a different kind of, it's a really, it's a very lean taste too. It's really specific.
Very much so. It's pheasant and chuckers and quail benefit from brining.
Yeah.
Chuckers a partridge.
Can I tell you a funny pheasant story? I swear this is true. Mm. So when I lived in
– this is a
true story.
Thing.
No, this is an Iowa story.
There you go.
let's see if this rings true with you at all. So I'm in Iowa, very young reporter. I go out on a first date. So we're driving. We're like
bounced off your windshield.
Even better, Hank. So we're driving down the road. We're kind of out in the country, which isn't hard to do in Iowa. And we're driving, and like I don't really know this person at all, right? So then all of a sudden, he pulls in by a ditch, stops the car, reaches into the back seat, rifle comes
up. Oh, with a picket charge.
You know where this is going.
Yeah.
Reaches across
shotgun,
the passenger
though.
Seat. Yep. Yeah, that's what it was. And it opens the door. Bam. Shoots a pheasant. I'm like – this is the part in the movie where the girl dies. I'm like, what was that? And he says, road hunting.
Yep.
Road hunting.
Yep.
Yeah.
It is a time-honored tradition in the Dakotas, yep. Kansas, Nebraska, and Iowa.
Yep. Yeah, and apparently first date material.
I'm not sure I'd agree with that.
Well, there was a second date, so I guess it went okay. You know, in closing, it's been really interesting to learn all of this. And like I said, I'm not, other than that one thing I just told you about, you know, super experienced with hunting, but I am really interested in conservation and in appreciating nature and in knowing where things come from and what you were talking about, just like using what is there. What's your big message that you hope people get out of everything that you're doing right now?
I think I alluded to it in the beginning. It's to find some aspect of wild food that really floats your boat and teach your friends, your family, and really get to know it, make it part of your family's DNA. So maybe it's just picking berries. Maybe it's digging clams. Maybe it is, you know, looking for morel mushrooms or something else like that. Maybe it's deer hunting. Maybe it's turkey hunting. Maybe it's duck hunting. Maybe it's making sure you catch salmon in the river or shad or whatever. There's so much around us. I mean, there's a reason I'm still here. Like, I can do what I do anywhere, but I live in Sacramento for a reason. And because the opportunity to make something of the wild world part of what your family does, no matter what. You don't have to be a hunter. You can be anti-hunting for all I care. Maybe it's going picking mushrooms or something. Do that and make it yours.
I think the other big thing to learn from all of this is if you're going to eat the mushroom, make sure you know what it is.
Oh, dude.
Or you have Hank on speed dial. Jeff, you want to wrap us up?
I think we covered pretty much everything.
Yeah. Got all your hunting questions. I mean, you got the expert here.
I mean, there are a million questions I could ask, but we don't have time to get into all of
them. Well, why don't I ask you the best ways for people to keep in touch with you and keep up on everything you're working on?
So I'm on Instagram as Hunt Gather Cook. I run a Facebook forum called Hunt Gather Cook as well. That's a closed forum, so you have to ask to be let in.
Like a secret knock too?
No, you just tell them, you know, you have to ask questions and stuff. Okay. Just say, hey, you heard it on the podcast. And then my website, and this is the core of what I do, is Hunter Angler Gardener Cook. It is, the URL for that is huntgathercook.com.
Before we leave, can we talk real quick about your pictures? Because while you do everything,
those are all hot. All the good ones are from my girlfriend Holly Heiser.
She's amazing.
She is.
The pictures are gorgeous on there.
So all of the decent photos are mine. All of the good photos are hers.
That's the right way to wrap this up. Thank you very much for coming in. And when is the next book coming out?
So we are working on a fish and seafood cookbook, and we're also working on a book of essays about hunting because we really want to create a book that a non-hunter can read and say, oh, I get it now. This is why we do what we do. And then conversely, like a hunter can hand it to someone in their life who doesn't hunt and say, this is why I do what I do. So it's kind of a bridge building book.
Perfect.
I like that.
Yeah. Thank you, Hank.
Thank you.
So we've had a lot of super interesting guests and a lot of, I've learned a lot on this show.
But he was your fave.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I could tell because you came up and you're like, hey, how about we get that buck moose guy? I'm like, yeah, make it happen. Next thing I know, like 10 minutes later, Jeff's like, yeah, we've got him on Wednesday. Fantastic. No, I found him fascinating. And I love his backstory of having this completely different life and then trying something that he really loved and then bringing along all these other people on his journey. It's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I have been foraging a little bit.
Oh, really?
I've been foraging for like ratings and reviews for the podcast, and we're kind of excited to let you know there's this thing called Chartable that charts podcasts across the country, and we're in, I don't know why we did this, but we put ourselves in the news and politics category. Like,
yeah.
It's kind of a weird fit, but it's also the most competitive. It's the most crowded category.
Yeah.
And our last episode with Nicole Root made it to like 134, which you might think, well, it's not top 100. It's a big, big deal because there are thousands and thousands. So it happened because you guys are sharing the podcast. And so, like, huge thanks from us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Just keep on keeping on. Send those reviews. Absolutely. Send those 5 stars. It's great.
We really appreciate it. You can follow the podcast on Instagram at Dying to Ask Podcast.
You can find me at Producer Jeff.
And I'm on Instagram at Run Read Sip. We appreciate you listening today. Share the podcast, and we'll see you again next week.
Bye.